On Monday, June 24th, we talked to an expert about what you should do if your kid is being bullied or if your child is bullying others. Also, Jim Cameron checked in with us on his latest thoughts regarding transportation tolls and trains. And we wound up the show talking to Ruth Canovey from the local chapter of the American Lung Association on a move by Connecticut now to raise the age to purchase tobacco products to 21. Our guest has been a longtime advocate for child safety and a crime and violence prevention specialist and consultant for 40 years. Her first book, Alternative to Fear, Guidelines for Safer Neighborhoods, helped launch the Neighborhood Watch Program in the early 70s. And who hasn't heard of the Neighborhood Watch Program? And we welcome to WICC 600 and WICC600.com. Stephanie Mann joins us. Stephanie, hi. Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks, Paul, for inviting me.
Oh, no problem. Listen, we're still looking at a lot of issues with raising kids today, Stephanie. And the reason I wanted to have you on is to talk about what I guess is still a continued problem here, is safety of kids around bullying and whether or not parents are doing enough to educate their kids and maybe prevent their own kids, Stephanie, from doing this.
Oh, well, you're absolutely right. Too many parents are not doing enough, and we can empower our kids to keep them safe in their own neighborhoods, communities, and schools. Many children are also experiencing, different kinds of problems, mm-hmm. but the most important thing you can do for your children is help them to be spiritually centered within themselves so they don't bully and they don't become a victim, because the bully is attracted to a child that is often sensitive, a little different, could have a handicap. But these children need to know that they can be strong within themselves so that they don't become a bully or a victim. And that's basically why I wrote Empowerment Parenting, How to Raise Resilient Children to Become Happy, Self-Reliant Adults.
And your website is safekidsnow.com. You know, when I was growing up, and obviously when you were growing up, we had bullies around. We had the schoolyard bully. You and I obviously were exposed to the neighborhood bully. But, you know, today it's frightening because it's so different. I mean, listen, I got in fights when I was growing up, but I wasn't cyber-bullied. I didn't have my reputation, any physical limitations, anything like my looks dragged through the computer gutter all around the world. It's just so much more frightening today than I know when you and I were growing up.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. The computer has made it very easy for kids that feel isolated, alone. Maybe they don't have friends, and they go look for friends in all the wrong places on the computer. This is something that parents have to be aware of, and I think more and more parents are aware of it, and they're monitoring their children. But you can't always be with your children, so you have to empower them from within themselves so they know how to protect themselves. And that's the whole reason for empowerment parenting, is helping kids learn how to handle their anger, understand that strength mm-hmm. comes through pain. We all get stronger if we do have some pain and we solve our own problems. Let me give you a quick example.
Sure.
Because I think this starts at a very early age. Mm-hmm. My son came home from school, and he said, he was crying. And he said, I don't want to go to school anymore. And I think plenty of parents have heard that. And mm-hmm. and I said to him, well, what happened? And he told me that little Johnny was picking on him and hitting him and making him feel very bad about himself. So I said to him, okay, the main character of the day that was popular was Superman.
Yeah.
And I said, put on your Superman costume and let those word bullets bounce off your chest. And he looked at me like I was, couldn't quite understand it. But he said, okay. And he went back to school. A couple of days later, he was home again crying. The same little bully was bothering him again. So I said, all right, and I repeated what I had said earlier. Did you put on your Superman costume and let those word bullets bounce off your chest? And he looked at me and he said, okay, I'll try. And about a week later, he came home all excited. And he said, I took care of little Johnny. And I thought, uh-oh. And he said, I told him I was going to punch him in the nose if he didn't stop it. And he said, and then he turned around and walked away, and he reported it to the teacher. So that was his way of solving his own problem and getting his self-esteem up and figuring out a solution for himself.
And Stephanie, what do you think of a lot of these anti-bullying ordinances that are popping up over the country that actually attach some responsibility to the parent about this whole thing? Do those work or not?
Well, let me first say that I think it's a very good thing that Wisconsin, some of the cities in Wisconsin are trying to tackle this. And what they're doing is bringing this whole topic to the media. And the media really needs to talk about how do we strengthen our families, because this isn't just a bully problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is also about the bully and I call them the pincushion kids. These are the invisible kids that are sensitive, that you really don't know they're in pain unless you have a good network, unless you have a good communication level at home. They're a lot of them are afraid to talk to their parents. Or they just feel that it's their fault. So we have to create a really positive environment in our home. And believe me, we don't have that in many families. We are spending $220 million a day on child abuse and neglect. That's what the taxpayers are paying. So obviously, this problem needs to be addressed. And I'm grateful for Wisconsin to at least bring this to the forefront about the bullies, because these children learn this behavior, generally speaking, at home. They see the conflict in the family. Domestic violence is a huge problem. We got way too many problems.
Yeah.
Child abuse, sexual abuse, and we need to be much more aware and be the peacemaker in our own families. That's another reason why Empowerment Parenting was written, because I saw, as a crime and violence prevention consultant and specialist for many years, the horror stories of working in families and having to report parents to CPS, and I didn't think that was a profitable or good way to handle this. Instead of just shipping kids off, we really need to empower our families. So that is why we have Empowerment Parenting booklet here. And also we need to create a network of support around children, and that is strengthening the neighborhood. Way back when, in my community, we had a crime wave.
Yeah.
That's how I got started with the Neighborhood Watch Program. We never heard of the Neighborhood Watch Program at that time. And we had a crime wave in my city. We had 17,500 residents.
Wow.
We had no local police. We had no city manager or any structure except the volunteers. That was it. We had this crime wave, and we had one representative through the county, and then we had some 1.5 police officers for our whole city. And we shared half of an officer with a neighboring city.
What city was this, Stephanie? Stephanie, what city was that?
Orinda, California.
And you had 1.5 police officers for 17,000 people.
That's correct.
Wow.
And we had no structure, no city council or anything. So we had to sit down and come up with a plan on how we were going to empower ourselves to stop the crime wave we had in our community. Well, we got together, 10 of us, and we sat down, we came up with a plan, and we called it the Neighborhood Responsibility Plan. Matter of fact, you can read the whole book that we wrote in the early 70s on our website, safekidsnow.com, and see how we did it. I published it on the website because I want people to know they have much more power than they think they have. Our children are much more powerful than we think they are.
Now
they
you said a couple of minutes ago that you actually, there was a time that you had to report bad parents, abusive parents to what they call CPS out there, Child Protective Services. It's a little different in every state.
Right.
What was that like? How did you handle making a decision to do that, Stephanie, to have to do that, knowing that it could, at least physically in the short term, break up some families?
Well, that was later. First, let me just say that we reduced our own crime problem 48% in the city of Orinda without a local police department. And that was by just getting neighbors together. Later on, I worked with the county, Contra Costa County, as a coordinator, and I saw abuse and so forth, and I didn't actually report it myself. I reported it to the police.
Well, sure, yeah.
And
yeah.
then they took it from there. But, you know, when we have children with a drug-addicted mother and a daughter being raped in the back room, and she was screaming, and the mother was so high on drugs, she simply said, "I tried to get her to shut up. I knew she was making too much noise." You know, you got a real problem here, and the mother isn't capable of handling much of anything. And she had two children, a 4-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter. So that's a case where there's no question what you have to do.
Stephanie Mann is the guest. SafeKidsNow.com. That is the website. Stephanie, what can a parent do? Let's say they are raising the child the best they can. Let's say it's a typical, good, intact, loving marriage, but for some, and there's not a lot of violence or conflict at home, but for some reason, the kid, the little boy or little girl or teen or whatever, they're just abusive to their classmates and their schoolmates. What's the answer there?
Well, I suggest that every household with smaller children there have a listening chair, or stool, put it in the kitchen or the family room, and anytime a child is angry or upset, have them sit down in that listening chair and say, "You know what? I'm going to listen to you. What is it that's making you so upset?" You may not know it. He may be abused by a relative. That is more common than you think. He may have a problem with his classmate, and he doesn't tell you that he's being bullied. So he is acting out, and you need to know why he is acting out. And that means good communication. And if you start young, communicating with your child, when he gets to be a teenager, he will continue to communicate with you. If you ignore the things that are happening to him in his life and he doesn't feel supported, he doesn't feel loved, you're going to find that he's going to do things that are going to make you really unhappy by the time he gets to be a preteen and teenager. So please, parents, start very young to improve your communication with your children. I've seen it make an enormous difference.
You were going to relate to us a story of two young children who had some sort of a breakthrough, a pair of brothers, I think you said. Go ahead.
Yes. The reason I learned this story was in a neighborhood meeting where people were talking about the kids and the problems they were having with children. And this lady explained how she used the listening chair. The two boys were 7 and 10, and they were always fighting with each other, much less kids at the school. So she had each boy sit down in the chair and tell their side of the story of why they were so angry and why they were so upset. So each boy took their turn, and they expressed their feelings, and mother was listening. And so to make a long story short, she said it took about 5 minutes, 10 minutes of the boys, because they were pretty angry kids. But finally, they shook hands and agreed to disagree on a few things, but okay. They left feeling much better, and I think it's very sad if we allow fighting to go on mm-hmm. in families because the children build up resentments,
yeah.
and it makes it difficult for them to sleep. It makes them difficult to have a healthy relationship as they're growing up. So the listening chair has been a wonderful vehicle that I've shared with a lot of people.
What if a parent or a guardian gets a call, Stephanie, from someone at their school, a teacher or a principal or a guidance counselor or somebody like that, and says, listen, I think we may have a problem with your son or daughter or stepson or stepdaughter, whatever. They're showing bullying tendencies. What are the first few things that a parent should do there?
Well, number one, acknowledge the fact and understand that the teacher is trying to help you and your child. They aren't there to get angry with you or to blame you. What they want to do is help you stop the problem now. So my son happens to be a teacher, and he said the behavior of a child, he said, I can almost immediately tell what kind of parent is going to come in to talk to me. That can be a good thing, and that can be a bad thing.
Yeah, I've heard that from I've heard that from friends of mine who are teachers too. The exact same thing. Yeah, yeah.
So children reflect what's happening in the home. If you have a happy, supportive home, children are going to be happy kids themselves. And if you listen to them, I can't emphasize that enough, that we have to have time and take time to listen to our children.
And
teachers.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think there's almost, Stephanie, some sort of a built-in, I don't want to call it a bias, but a built-in expectation that kids cannot have critical thinking or express themselves in a way that would give some sort of insight when they absolutely can. And oftentimes, as you probably found, right, at a very young age.
Oh, my goodness. I think children have the amazing wisdom at a very early age. But it's up to the parents to bring that that amazing inner power out so that child lives and grows from within. If you have somebody trying to control children and hovering over them like a helicopter parent,
yeah.
You've got a big problem there, because you are weakening your children instead of strengthening them. We all learn our lessons through pain. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Solving problems at an early age is like a stepping stone of empowering ourselves, of making us feel better about ourselves, because we solve the problem. If somebody else does it, you're going to see, and mm-hmm. we are seeing, adults sitting on the couch at age 22.
Yeah.
Or 20,
yeah.
They don't have no motivation.
Yeah.
They have total dependence on their parents. So it's a balance, mm-hmm. balancing act as a parent. And it's not an easy balancing act, because you can't overprotect. And you can't underprotect.
Yeah.
You've got to find that balance that works for you.
Believe me, you and I both know it as being parents. The name of the book is Empowerment Parenting, How to Raise Resilient Children Who Become Happy, Self-Reliant Adults. Once again, Empowerment Parenting, How to Raise Children Who Become Happy, Self-Reliant Adults. The website, SafeKidsNow.com. The guest has been Stephanie Mann, a long career in dealing with this sort of stuff. Stephanie, thank you. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
We feature on those podcasts from time to time our buddy Jim Cameron, who joins us. Jim is the commuter reporter, commuter writer. Can I call you Captain Commuter, or would you prefer not? Because I think you're kind of the superhero for the downtrodden that have to ride Metro North, Jim, and ride the highways here. You know what I mean?
I think advocate for the interests of commuters is plenty. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, for joining us. Sorry about my email where I transposed the 0 and the 5, but we'll leave that to the listeners.
It's in your email, not in your paycheck.
Oh, please. Good Lord, please. Hey, listen, your last, I loved your last column where you were talking about something that you and I have discussed, and I've discussed a lot here. The fact that we have just, people are like, oh, we don't believe you in Hartford. We just, sorry, you can say all you want, but we just don't believe you.
Well, let's just pile on then a little bit more on this cynicism trail here. You know, I've been writing about transportation for over a decade. I was on the Commuter Council, so I write for the Connecticut Post and all of the Hearst newspapers now. And I've been talking about the need to invest in Metro North and our highways to fix our bridges for years.
Mm-hmm.
So along comes Lamont, and it looks like he's got this idea about doing tolling, and I endorse the idea. I've been supporting the idea of tolling our highways for many, many years. But I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think he's got the votes. And the reason is he and his team have completely fumbled this issue. They never really explained the need, the necessity for tolling. And they allowed the opponents of tolling, mm-hmm. Mr. Sasser and his anti-toll trolls, as I call them, to completely occupy the news, to organize themselves into a grassroots campaign and to galvanize this cynicism and this skepticism that Hartford can do nothing that's going to be useful to us. And I think they have really turned around public opinion against tolling, to the extent that I don't think the legislature's got the votes to support tolling, and I don't think they're going to be able to get it through in a special session.
Jim, I was told by a couple of legislators up there, and this probably wouldn't come as any surprise to you, that they're looking at the long game here, at least at this point. And, you know, the state Senate seems to be a sizable margin for Democrats at, you know, 22 to 14. Well, a couple of those folks, Alex Bergstein from Greenwich and the state senator from Waterbury, Joan Hartley, they are kind of fiscal conservatives. So you knock off two on the other side, Jim. So you go from 22 to 14 to 20 to 16. And I've been told that, yes, there is a real fear among the rank and file Dems at the Capitol that pushing tolls through, as much as some people say we need them, is going to cost them the state Senate in the next cycle in 2020. And that's a big fear they have up there right now. Part and parcel, Jim, as you say, because they haven't made their case sufficiently.
And I can absolutely understand that. I think that the pressure on lawmakers who will be looking at election possibilities next year, if they vote in favor of tolls, it's going to be a really tough argument. But let's just assume the worst case. Let's, from my perspective, let's assume they don't have the votes for tolls. What's plan B? What are we going to do to come up with the money that we need to spend one way or another to fix our roads, fix our bridges, keep our trains running, okay? That's what nobody is discussing. I'm giving you a tease on an upcoming column I'm going to write.
Interesting.
And none of the opportunities that we're going to be looking at are going to be favorable. Let me just tick off a couple of the alternatives.
Sure, yep.
Because the money needs to be spent, okay? If it's not going to be in tolls, it's going to be in an increase in the sales tax, an increase in the income tax, higher fares or reductions in service on the trains and the buses, or we're just going to allow our highways and bridges to deteriorate further. Okay, so if you aren't in favor of tolls, got it. Understand that. You think it's a tax and all that crap. I don't believe that for a moment.
Jim, before the break there, you were going to outline a couple of what might be the alternatives here, as sour as they may be. Go ahead.
Well, I was enjoying listening to your traffic report, as I always do.
And, Jim, it's always heavy from 2 to 27. That's it. There's the
I know. And you know what? The people that are driving on that highway or are listening to your show right now are probably banging their steering wheels saying, why can't somebody fix this? Right? Well, I understand that. I understand that frustration. And the answer, I think, is going to be some sort of spending. And if it's not tolls, mm-hmm. folks, get ready for other kinds of taxes. You know, there's going to be some way that if the necessity of repairing our roads is going to be paid for. And, you know, pick your poison, folks. If you don't like tolls, and I support tolls because I think they are a user fee, they're paid by people that drive on the highways. And if you don't like that, then everybody's going to pay. And a sales tax increase, an income tax increase, one of those is going to be a necessity and an inevitability. So, you know, don't get your knickers in a knot if you don't think the tolls are going to get passed.
You know, Jim, and one thing that I have heard and read and talked to people about, and frankly some legislators have said, one of the issues they say, you've probably heard this too, that makes the toll thing distasteful and has given ammunition to the other side, the anti-toll side on this, from tales in other states, is what would be this toll commission, which would, in a sense, be largely unelected. It would be an odd number of people. The governor would appoint one person. There'd be representatives from the current administration, from whatever that may be. And a lot of people have talked to, I have said, you know what, this is kind of a Pontius Pilate thing where it absolves any future legislators from having to vote up or down on toll increases. Some people say that's bad. Some people say that's good because this shouldn't be politicized. I think that's a major thing that they've got working against them.
Well, you know, I mean, I absolutely understand that cynicism because I think the legislature has proven itself to be gutless weasels. I mean, look at the rats that they stuffed into that budget.
Yeah.
Pay increases for their own staff. The idea of spending millions of dollars studying burying I-95 like a giant big dig all along the coast. I mean, my column ticked off a number of the things that were slipped into the budget by the legislature who didn't have the guts to hold public hearings or actually vote on these issues up or down. So I understand completely the idea of creating a third party to be responsible and to be able to point fingers of blame to for other, you know, spending increases that were necessary. So lawmakers would never say, I voted for tolls. No, blame them. I mean, this goes back not just to Malloy, but to Rell and to Roland, you know, the lawmakers in the governor's office who were constantly dipping into the special transportation fund, stealing money that was set aside for transportation to balance the budget, to play that shell game as they do every year with the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just so fed up that the people that we send to Hartford who claim to be so well-intentioned don't have the guts to do an up or down vote on something as crucial as paying for our transportation network. I've been an optimist for so many years on this issue, but I'm just fed up, guys. I'm just sorry.
Yeah, no, Jim, I mean, and again, when you have, and you've been in the communications media business like I have for years, what's the one thing that our early bosses, especially in the news business, ram into us, Jim? One word, credibility, right? That's the one thing they say, and I've had bosses and morning show partners and afternoon show partners who've all said the same thing. When you lose your credibility, you might as well open a window and just throw anything else with it out the window. Because once you've lost your credibility, it's real tough to sally on here.
And it's not just because the Democrats have had a supermajority. You know, I'm no more confident that the Republicans, if they were the ones that were in charge of everything, would do anything differently. It's the way the system has been operated. And I think that Governor Lamont needs to exercise a line item veto, which, you know, we haven't used in decades in this state, but is allowed. He should conduct a line item veto on some of those rats that were stuffed into that budget bill and tell lawmakers, I'm going to call you back and we're going to do it until we get it right. And, you know, you got summer vacation plans? Sorry, guys. We're going to do a special session. We're going to really do it right this time. Tolls and a whole bunch of other things that you just didn't seem to have time to deal with.
Jim Cameron is the guest. He writes the commuter column, of course, the commuter advocate and reporter for the Connecticut Post, Hearst Newspapers. Jim, I know this wouldn't solve the specter of the out-of-state driver. I get that. But what about some of these states, Jim, that are now using usage fees by the mile? I know this is being experimented with out in the western part of the U.S. You know, once a year you go to, just the way we go to get our car's emissions tested every couple of years, you know, once a year you go to a center, they write down your mileage this year, they subtract that from last year. Oh, you drove 2,000 miles, we charge you a penny a mile, and you pay $200. What are your feelings on something like that?
That's called a vehicle miles tax. It's being tested in Oregon and in California. It's already in effect in some European countries. It was one of the proposals that the Malloy's Transportation Finance Panel came up with. In addition to tolls and gas taxes, they said, let's take a look at this idea. You know, basically just charge you on the number of miles that you drive. That idea was floated by Malloy and was immediately shot down, even by the Democrats, who found it so onerous and so big brother-like that, oh, my God, someone's going to know where I'm driving. No, they don't know where you're driving.
No, they don't know that.
They just know how many miles you've driven. The Democrats, under Bob Duff, the Senate Majority Leader from Norwalk, actually pushed a bill through prohibiting the DOT from even studying that idea. That's what kind of Luddites we're dealing with. In the legislature. Now, you know, I don't care where you're driving. You tell your wife you're going to the library and you end up at a strip club. I don't care. I just care if you've been driving on the highways and breaking up I-95 and making the potholes bigger. You know, your wife may not know where you are. Your cell phone knows where you are. I mean, look at your Google Analytics.
Oh, sometimes. Yeah.
NSA and the FBI and every state agency.
Yeah,
they know where you are minute by minute.
It's amazing, Jim, when I'm driving in Norwalk and suddenly, oh, look at that, restaurant ads for every fish house in Norwalk pop up on my phone. Son of a gun. How did that happen?
You're not looking at your phone while you're driving, though, I hope, right?
No, well, only when I'm in the rest stop, Jim. Only when I'm... Jim, it's always a pleasure, my friend. Well, no,
buying gas at the rest stop in Connecticut.
You are
a patriot.
I'm participating in the fine cuisine that we have on the on the I-95 rest stops. You know, hey Jim, when you got to have your coffee and croissant, you need it, baby. All right, Jim Cameron.
Yeah,
Jim, thank you. Great column, and we'll talk in a few weeks again. Thanks, buddy.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
Appreciate it, Jim Cameron. There, Connecticut Post, Hearst Connecticut Papers, the Commuter Advocate writes the commuter column, watching all things roads and train-wise. A few days ago, Governor Ned Lamont signing House Bill 7200, officially raising the age of sale for all tobacco products to 21 years old. So Connecticut becomes the 16th state to do so. Now, of course, the American Lung Association, they're very happy about that. No surprise there. And joining us from the association is Ruth Canovi, who is the advocacy officer for Connecticut. Ruth, hi. It's Paul here on WICC. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Thanks for having me here today.
So, Ruth, you and the folks at the association obviously must have been thrilled, I would think, with Connecticut becoming the 16th state to do this.
Yes. Absolutely. We are thrilled. It's an issue that we've been working on for a few years. And so we're really excited and thankful and want to congratulate lawmakers and the administration, local governments and advocates for really championing such an important issue.
Were you surprised that Connecticut did it?
I feel like this year at the start of the legislative session, I was the most hopeful that I had been in a long time. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like there was just so much more energy around the issue and people really understanding that tobacco is still a very real issue in the country and in our state. We've made some progress, but it still remains the leading cause of preventable disease in the state and the country. And I think just from conversations that I had been having with people in the community and lawmakers, there was a lot of momentum for that this year. And so I was skeptically optimistic at the beginning of session, so I'm really pleased with the outcome for sure.
Is this a scenario, Ruth, where the main impetus behind this was to keep these products away from younger kids when the smoking age was, in fact, 18 and some of those 18-year-olds were still in high schools?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that we just have been seeing a strong, strong increase in the number of youth who are using products, especially like the non-traditional electronic cigarette devices. We saw, I mean, the U.S. Surgeon General has been calling it an epidemic. The rates have gone up. They went up 78% in 1 year. And so that's really significant. And so we're seeing that so many young kids were getting them from social circles and their social connections. So the aim is that we get them out of the high schools and middle schools and kind of just remove that one step further. And we're seeing that kids' brains are so susceptible to nicotine. So the hope is that as we decrease access, we can really move forward and hopefully get much less of an impact for tobacco on youth around the state,
Ruth,
and then hopefully
Ruth,
all of us.
Before the e-cigarettes really kicked in, which was, I guess, what, like 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, I started to see these vape shops around where I was living and started to hear from parents I knew who were talking about this. When we were still talking about traditional tobacco products, mainly cigarettes, what was the trend like back then? Was there, was it a static trend with just regular smoking products in high schools and elementary schools, or were we seeing a decrease? How have the numbers changed over the years?
I mean, since I think we kind of see, we saw those numbers peak in the late 90s with youth tobacco use overall, and kind of since the late 90s with changes in policies were really pretty effective, removing them from the scenes of like bars and those kinds of things and getting smoke-free workplace laws, increasing the cost, and just more education. I think we've done a really good job of getting people to be like, oh, you know, cigarettes, we don't do that. But I, you know, and that was for the mainstream. We still see some pockets of the population that has disproportionately high use rates.
What are some of those? What are some of those? That's interesting, Ruth. What are maybe one or two of those pockets of population that you're having trouble getting down? Can you share a couple?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that when you look at socioeconomic rates, so folks who have like a GED or don't have a high school diploma have higher rates of tobacco use. And also people who have mental health and addiction issues in general, that rates, tobacco rates in that population are really high.
So it's tough to crack that nut to say to get those smoking blocks down.
Yes, right. But then with the introduction of electronic cigarettes, we are still continuing to see kids who, you know, would have said, oh, even when you ask them, do you smoke? It's no. And then it's kind of like, well, do you use those vaping products? Do you know that there's nicotine in them? Lots of times they don't even know that there's nicotine in them. So we're seeing kind of a reversal of that,
and you know,
progress.
Ruth, the vaping thing, it's too bad in a way, because I think vaping is getting a little bit of a bad rap now, because I know 4 or 5 adult friends of mine who have stopped smoking. Now, they do vape. Some of them vape constantly. A couple of them vape rarely now. But I do know some adult friends of mine who have stopped smoking because they are using the liquid nicotine products.
Right. I know. And we hear this a lot. And so, I mean, one thing that we generally say is that, so the Food and Drug Administration has some like 7 approved cessation treatments. Mm-hmm. So that they've been proven, they've gone through some rigorous, you know, treatment and testing, and we know that those are, and they're regulated. So we know that they can help people quit. With electronic cigarettes, we hear that anecdote, and so we would like more science on that. And if that comes to fruition at some point, I mean, the more options for people to quit, fantastic. But I think these products have not been on the market for a very long time in terms of where we can see what the long-term effects are. And so I am hesitant. I understand and I hear that a lot.
Sure, yeah.
And so, but I think, you know, we still need more data for that piece. And the fact that when you look at who's using these products, youth are using them at much, much higher rates.
Ruth, I'm old enough to remember, and it just shows you how times have changed. Like you mentioned before, I'm old enough to remember where at my high school, if you were 18, now you couldn't smoke in the building, but they set aside, and I went to a private high school, but they set aside like this little area in the back. It was next to a dumpster where that was the quote unquote smoking area. Yes.
Yeah.
And out of, there were 246 guys in my class. I'm thinking maybe 25 guys smoked. So it wasn't that much. You know, I graduated in 79, but it's wild to go back a couple of, as you often probably think of too, go back a couple of generations and how normalized this was, even in school settings.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, it has changed. People always have those stories. And even not, I think in the late or in the mid 80s in Connecticut, the smoking age was 16 and then it increased to 18. So times have changed, but I think that says a lot that we're responding to science and policy recommendations from, you know, so that we can really protect people's public, you know, protect people's health.
The fact that this is concentrated mainly on young folks. I know you mentioned before the jury still being out as far as you folks are concerned with vaping and the liquid nicotine. The thing is, I know that disturbs people is the fact that some of these nicotine products, a lot of them, in fact, Ruth, are flavored, and that is a real hook, apparently, right? That gets these kids to try it and really become hooked on nicotine at a young age.
Yes, for sure. I mean, you've got flavors like gummy bear and cotton candy, things like that that are definitely things that we associate with youth. And so, and I've been in this situation where I've been like, what's that vapor, right? Or what's that smell?
And
it does not have the traditional tobacco smell, but it's there, and it's the question of, all right, what's in this stuff? And these products really aren't regulated by the Federal and Drug Administration or Food and Drug Administration, rather. There is push to have it be the case so that they are regulated, but right now there's no way to really say that, oh, if something says that there's zero nicotine in it, that's actually what the case is, because they're not being regulated right now.
Yeah, and you would,
that's a major issue.
Yeah, and you would think, Ruth, that, okay, if it's going to exist, you don't want to create a black market here. It's very tough to get rid of this stuff. But yeah, regulation, at least for safety reasons, for, you know, how much nicotine can be delivered with each puff and what the concentration can be in those little vials they buy. I would think that's something that would make sense in the future.
Right, so that people know what they're, that and can trust that if they're buying this, they can trust that they know what they're buying.
Ruth, what is the situation, if you folks watch this too, which I guess you might, you know, we talk all the time about traditional tobacco products, pipes, cigarettes, cigars.
Yeah.
We talk about nicotine stuff. What is the situation currently with other tobacco products, with things like snuff and the traditional, what they used to call chew, you know, Red Man, which, you know, I've heard, you know, Ruth, I hear anecdotes from people involved in, you know, like high school sports, and there are guys who use snuff and guys who chew and everything as juniors and seniors in high school. That still goes on.
It does. It does. And unfortunately, the data that we have isn't necessarily stratified out to all of the specific types that people use. But when we actually look at like tobacco use as a group, we haven't seen that same decline that we were seeing from those, you know, late 90s. And when we don't take out those, you know, cigarettes. Unfortunately, some of those other products are still being used, and new products are coming onto the market all the time. There's like these breath strips that look like Listerine breath.
Oh, you know, come on, really?
That have nicotine in them. So the industry that we're dealing with is creative and responds to the declining market of their traditional products. So unfortunately, that means that health organizations, people who care about this stuff, educators, community need to pay attention and try to respond to this so that we're all educated about it.
Connecticut is the 16th state to raise the sale of all tobacco products to 21. Within, Ruth, the next 2, 3, maybe 5 years, how many more states do you think will hop on that bandwagon to raise the age to 21? Where do you see that going?
Well, I mean, just for kind of a point of reference, when we started the legislative session this year, we were saying 6 states had raised the age. So that's a pretty significant move, and I think that we're expecting at least one more to jump, you know, add to this list this year. And we're even hearing talk about some federal regulation on this front as well. So I think that this policy is really gaining popularity and momentum. I mean, when you look at even just Connecticut as an example, this year there were 92 co-sponsors on this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Last year there were 43. So it's really jumped in people really getting that, oh, this is an issue, you know,
yeah.
They've heard enough from this. So I don't think that we're going to be alone in this. And we've got a wide variety of states that have taken action as well. So some of our neighbors, like Vermont and Massachusetts and Maine, but Virginia and Texas are other groups or states that have passed this. So I don't think that this is going to be the end of this issue.
Finally, Ruth, obviously you must have gotten pushback on this from the tobacco companies at the national and local level. Did I read correctly that some of the pushback also may have come from some owners of convenience stores and neighborhood stores who thought this was a little onerous? Did I read that right?
I think so. I think there was, you know, a lot of concern throughout. How is this going to impact our business?
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, a few years ago, we were talking about how is the loss of revenue going to impact the state? And so I'm glad that we got past that and were able to pass this. But, you know, people were looking out for themselves. But I think that we are seeing some real promise. And I'm excited. I've been doing some of this work for a while, and this is the best tobacco policy that I've seen Connecticut pass in a number of years. So I'm pleased and really thank the champions that worked really hard on this.
Ruth, thank you. Ruth Canovi, the Director of Advocacy in Connecticut for the American Lung Association. Ruth, thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it and hope to speak to you again in the future. Thanks so much.
Thank you for covering this. I appreciate it.
No problem. Ruth Canovi there. Once again, she is Director of Advocacy in Connecticut for the American Lung Association.